You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE, Fenner, Syracuse, 88.1, Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP, Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP, Salida, WGDR, Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW, Kingsville, WRFN, Nashville, KRBS, Oroville, The Surge, 96.3, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The United States government made dozens of treaties with Native nations and has broken them all. In the last few decades, many of those nations have gone to court to demand enforcement or compensation for these violated treaties. Last year, the Onondaga Nation in central New York State filed a groundbreaking land claim against the state of New York. Unlike other claims by Native nations, which sought monetary compensation or casino rights, the Onondaga are asserting their traditional role of earth stewardship to the seventh generation, as laid out in their Great Law of Peace, to heal their beautiful ancestral territories that have been devastated by industrial pollution. Onondaga Land Rights and Our Common Future is a year-long series of educational programs sponsored by Neighbors of the Onondaga Nation, a grassroots organization of Central New Yorkers which recognizes and supports the sovereignty of the traditional government of the Onondaga Nation. This week on the program, we're pleased to bring you part one of that series, The Nation in Our Midst, Onondaga History, Culture, and Spirituality, with Onondaga leaders Tadadaho Sid Hill and clan mother Audrey Shenandoah. But first, we'll begin with an historical overview of the treatment and attitude of the European settlers toward Native Americans with Professor John Marciano from his public class lecture series based on Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Marciano is a professor emeritus of SUNY Cortland and now lives in Southern California. John Marciano.
Okay, let's talk about Chapter 7, As Long as Grass Grows or Water Runs. I thought we'd start with a quote from former president, the late president, late a long time ago, evidently, Teddy Roosevelt, that would establish the fundamental premise that really undergirds the European and Euro-American views toward the original Americans. And I quote, "It is indeed a warped, perverse, and silly morality which would forbid a course of conquest that has turned whole continents into the seats of mighty and flourishing civilizations. All men of sane and wholesome thought soon dismiss with impatient contempt the plea that these continents should be reversed." It's not reversed. Reserved is the word, excuse me, yes. Not reversed. We're going to reserve this for the use of scattered savage tribes whose life was but a few degrees less meaningless, squalid, and ferocious than that of the wild beasts with whom they hold joint ownership. End of quote. What a guy. Evidently, those of us who have a total and profound disagreement with Teddy Roosevelt's racist views must be insane. I don't have the year. Probably late 1890s, maybe early 1900s. Let's see, became president when, forget the name of the gentleman who killed McKinley, wounded McKinley in at the Pan Am Exposition in Buffalo, New York. I used to take my kids, no, not to see the site. We used to go sledding there. It's in Delaware Park in Buffalo, and it's right across the, right across the grassy knoll. Now, with that as sort of foundation, Zinn points out, of course, that when we went through schools and also comments that we heard in the media, but especially with our schooling, that the polite term Indian removal was used, which essentially meant, when we decode it, aggression and clearing the land for white settlers. And of course, when we talked about in the chapter last time in Columbus, the white settlers came here to essentially an empty continent. There was no one here. They evidently didn't see the anywhere from 7 to 17 million original Americans who were wandering around in what is now North America. I want to tie together Zinn's comments with the fundamental premises underlying the policies toward original Americans that was put forth in Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's article. And I commend that article to you. If you haven't looked at it yet, please do. It's called The Grid of History, Cowboys and Indians. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, who's at Cal State Hayward, I believe, in the history department, she argues that the United States, a formal political entity called the United States, became an expansionist and imperialist power in 1776. It has been since, and military conquest is and has been at the heart of this empire. That is, it is as American as apple pie, motherhood, and used to be Chevrolet. And that those of us who are critical of the present war in Iraq and other single U.S. actions, and we could list them, and you just throw a dart on the globe, Panama, Grenada, or start in this hemisphere. She's saying that those who see single actions as aberrations, that is, an exception to an otherwise noble and benevolent foreign policy, are simply wrong. And that we can only do this by erasing history, the history which is at the heart of any anti-imperialist critiques that need to be made of our present foreign policy. Her argument is to see what's happening in Iraq can only be done as somehow as if it's an accident to an otherwise 230-year history means that we hide the continuity and a small departure is exaggerated. She also argues that white supremacy is absolutely essential to understanding the genocidal assault on first Americans by Europeans, and that this ideology of white supremacy can be traced to two things: the colonizing ventures of the Christian Crusades into Muslim areas, and most importantly for U.S. history, the Calvinist Protestant colonization of Ireland. That these were the models for the colonization of the Western Hemisphere and the assaults against indigenous Americans or American Indians. I want to examine briefly one aspect of her critique and then tie it into Zinn's discussion of American Indians. That is the defining power and views of Puritanism and Calvinist Protestantism that uniquely define white supremacy as a political and religious ideology. They were the chosen people who had a covenant with God that essentially meant ethnic cleansing of the nation by removing the Indian savages. The Ulster Scots Calvinists who ended up here first were the settlers and colonizers of Northern Ireland. Their origin story, many of them ending up settling in what is now the Allegheny, Appalachian areas of the United States, their origin story becomes the official U.S. origin story. They are the pilgrims or the settlers doing God's will and forging the promised land while being surrounded by savages and, of course, shedding their blood, which is a sanctifying act, first against the Irish in Ulster and then Native Americans here. She argues also that the ideology of white supremacy has also served as a political diversion and release valve for those in power in the United States as it neutralized and undermined class antagonisms of the landless and poor whites against the landed and rich, and in which we have a distribution of confiscated lands and properties of the Irish in Ireland and of American Indians and then blacks in the United States. She argues further that the English and colonist policy of exterminating Indians here was foreshadowed by the English assault and violence in Northern Ireland, where the ancient Irish social system was attacked, whole clans slaughtered, and the remainder brutalized. That is, the search and destroy process that the English used in Ireland was then brought to the United States, and of course later in the Philippines and in Vietnam, that similar process was used against the Filipinos and the Vietnamese. The Calvinist Protestant settlers here were told that they were doing God's will for salvation here, as well as in Ireland, for salvation and, of course, title to Irish lands. Salvation alone wouldn't be enough. The native Irish Catholics, of course, were clearly not destined for salvation, and this process was repeated in the Americas against Indians. Therefore, the founding of the United States as a political state, and when you go back and read very, very carefully the words of the founders, when you read Jefferson and you read George Washington and you read Benjamin Franklin, every time I go down Montana and see the little quotes there from Ben Franklin on that school, I'm reminded of some of the attitudes that Franklin had. He was kind of ambivalent, but he had very, very racist attitudes about Indians, even though he recognized that especially those in the Iroquois Confederacy were instrumental in teaching the colonists about democracy. So the founding of the U.S. as a political state is tied to this settler mentality, and Dunbar Ortiz argues that we did not just found a propertied, slave-owning, white male republic, but also a settler, colonialist, and imperialist aggressor state. And one of the preeminent figures in that origin story, in that history, if you've got a $20 bill, you can pull it out, is our friend Andrew Jackson, who coined the phrase, extending the area of freedom, which she argues essentially meant extending slavery into Texas in violation of Mexican laws, quickly followed by a slaveholder's rebellion and recognition by the United States in annexation. The term freedom was a code term for the continental and worldwide expansion of the world's leading slave power. And we often forget that at that point. The United States was the leading slave power in the world at that time. White supremacy was therefore the working ideology for the English theft of Indian lands and especially for the justification of slavery. And this ideology is tied closely to our origin myth, which itself, when you look at the history, it's closely tied to the parallel Afrikaner myth in South Africa in terms of white settlers going into a savage area, bringing Christianity with them. This white supremacy ideology formed the core of U.S. foreign relations from the founding of the nation to the present, and American supremacy and imperialism are inseparable from this origin story and from the definition of patriotism. Therefore, white supremacy and imperialism are the lifeblood of the U.S. state, an argument that is even hard to take for radicals who consider themselves anti-imperialists and who oppose some aspects of U.S. foreign policy. I would argue that in her work and Zinn, that they complement each other in developing a thesis that the U.S. was and remains essentially imperialist and racist, and this is not a divergence from a well-intentioned past, which is what essentially we learned in schools. That is, that we have and are always doing good when we go abroad. We're just absolutely so zealous at doing good that sometimes we make mistakes because we're just trying to spread, like Johnny Appleseed, trying to spread democracy and freedom around the world. She categorically rejects that perspective. She asserts that U.S. citizens like to pretend that we have no imperial and expansionist past, yet this began with our colonial days, often at the expense of Indians and Mexicans, and has been a marked feature of U.S. history that has continued with the imperial conquest of Hawaii as well. I mean, it's interesting if you read the history of how the United States ended up with Hawaii. It's fascinating. I forget when Hawaii became a state, but who had any idea what the history was? So the conflict that founded this country, which was a violent conflict, it was a war of independence. Sometimes it's been called a war of national liberation. She would argue essentially was a war for expansion. So understanding the real nature of U.S. expansion is absolutely critical to the context that Zinn develops in this chapter. That is, to understand the actual historical record as opposed to the fairy tale school textbook version that we got. That is, if we were to understand his arguments about American Indians and the centuries long, one could go back, it depends. You could go back to the war between colonists in the Pequots in what is now Connecticut in 1607. And if you end that long, long history of wars, let's say with the Wounded Knee in 1890, you're talking almost 300 years. So wars, many wars by Europeans and Euro-Americans. Zinn also discusses, of course, it goes back to Andrew Jackson, in many ways sort of the archetypal figure, Indian killer, slave trader, speculator, merchant, and then president in the context of a series of treaties with Indians of the Southwest, all of which were broken, by the way. I've looked at a number of scholarly sites and argue that every single treaty signed by the United States with American Indian nations has been broken. And, of course, the United States can only sign treaties with sovereign nations. You know, the U.S. can't sign a treaty with Hoboken, New Jersey. So every single treaty has been broken. And many of those treaties that were broken, of course, in white Europeans and Euro-Americans getting land, including Jackson, they benefited from land being taken from the Indians. And of course, this history includes the Seminole War in what is now Florida, which until the Vietnam War was the longest war in U.S. history in terms of the number of years. And yet, you know, every time now and then when you turn on ESPN and you know, I watch the sports news and they show Florida State University, the Seminoles, there's still a guy riding around on a horse with, you know, big feathers, etc., and they're doing that tomahawk thing, which the Atlanta Braves fans do also, which is why every time the Atlanta Braves is in a playoff of the World Series, I root for the other team. I don't care who they're playing. So the war with the Seminole led up to what we learned was called, remember, the Florida Purchase of 1819. We sort of purchased Florida, okay? What did we learn about Jackson in our school texts and classrooms? I was just telling Sammy what I learned in my American history class at the University of Rochester as we read Arthur Schlesinger Jr.'s The Age of Jackson. Schlesinger was a big Kennedy advisor and admirer, and my professor, Richard Wade, was a big history honcho of that time and also was a big Kennedy fan. I mean, we learned about Jackson, the Democrat, the soldier, the frontiersman, the man of the people. We did not learn about Jackson, the slave owner, the land speculator, and the mad dog killer of Indians. And he was a mad dog killer, let's not mince any words. So we have to ask ourselves, when it comes to what we've learned, is how we can become critically literate about the history of the country in which we now live and the issues that affect us and the historical past without having the whole record in front of us. And we need to question the role of educators, and I extend that to the media and the clergy, in passing on uncritically the views of dominant elites and others and keeping us blind and not giving us critical tools, so therefore we're unable to challenge the dominant views, which means then when we teach, we reproduce what's been given to us, which means you're forced to teach some of the depressing reality of U.S. history, which is why when I use Zinn's book, my students would always get depressed, very depressed. It's negative. It's a negative book. Yeah, it is negative at times, okay? But it's also a book of resistance. It's very negative when a group of people come in, take people's land, slaughter them, force them to march on the Trail of Tears. Thousands die. They starve. Extremely negative. Very depressing. Zinn shares an important quote from Secretary of War Lewis Cass on human nature, progressive improvement, and the fundamental difference between whites and savages. Now, all of these differences are based on fundamental philosophic assumptions about human nature and people. By progressive development, Cass and others at that time, of course, meant the rule of private property and capitalism as opposed to the sustainable economy and what we might call primitive communism of Indians, in which land was held in common. Right? If people faced droughts and terrible conditions, people suffered as a people. If there were wonderful conditions, they gained as a people. There was no question of the elders or the leaders in those nations living in incredible mansions while other people starved. Cass's comment reflects the fact that our fundamental premises about human nature are the foundation of all views on Indians and U.S. policies. We build our social, economic, and political views upon the base of what it means to be human. Zinn comments on Cass's quite marvelous ignorance of Indian life that the original Americans, quote, a barbarous people, depending for subsistence upon the chase, cannot live in contact with a civilized community. Given what we usually define as civilized, we must ask, who truly were the civilized, Euro-Americans or Indians. As we discussed last month, and I will repeat this, for a long time, Native Americans have been rebuking textbook authors and others who have reserved the adjective civilized for Europeans. They have criticized this view as unjust, quote, unjust to the life of our people. What is civilization? Its marks are a noble religion and philosophy, original art, stirring music, rich story, and legend. We had these. Then we were not savages, but a civilized race. And we should also add the clear governance structures with far more equality and reciprocity than were found in the Euro-American government structures, including the United States, where, for example, women did not gain full formal political equality till 1920, and repressed racial minorities did not gain full access to the vote until the mid-1960s. That kind of equality existed in Native American nations centuries ago. In his book, another book that I used in the years past in my classes, Lies My Teacher Told Me, by sociologist James Lowen, Lowen asserts that historically American Indians have been the most lied about subset of our population. That's why in learning about Native Americans, quote, one does not start from point zero, but from minus 10. Study of the history of Indian people and relations with European invaders cannot be a happy one. Lowen argues that if we are to look Indian history squarely in the eye, we are going to get red eyes. We are going to weep and become enraged. This is our past, and we must acknowledge it. And the problem is that the picture, even now, though the textbooks have been improved, the picture of the primitive savage enmeshed in wars with nature and other humans often drives the textbooks, and especially the textbooks for those of us who are older, that imposes a particular view on the ancient past. So in the encounter, when we started with the encounter with Columbus, we have to ask some fundamental questions. In the encounter between Europeans and savages in the Americas that began in 1492, who truly terrorized whom? Who enslaved whom? Who destroyed lands and cultures? And what have we learned about these horrors in our schools and media? As I mentioned before, a basic and fundamental fact is that each and every treaty signed formally by the United States government with Indian nations was broken by the U.S. It takes a monumental level of arrogance and hypocrisy for our political leaders to condemn such actions by other governments now, or, of course, as we used to hear all the time during the Cold War, that you couldn't trust the Soviet Union or China or Vietnam or anybody else because they're always breaking treaties, when in fact breaking treaties has been also been as American as apple pie since 1776. Zinn discusses the various and sordid means whites used to rob Indians of their lands, from outright violence to alcohol to fraud. And on page 135, he quotes from Dale Van Evry's book, The Disinherited, and I'll just quote some of this. Van Evry says, "In the long record of man's inhumanity, exile has wrung moans of anguish from many different peoples. Upon no people could it ever have fallen with a more shattering impact than upon the Eastern Indians," and you could extend that as well. "The Indian was particularly susceptible to every sensory attribute of every natural feature of his surroundings." His and her, you'd have to change the gender. "He lived in the open. He knew every marsh, glade, hilltop, rock, spring, creek, as only the hunter can know them. He had never fully grasped the principle establishing private ownership as any more rational than private ownership of the air, but he loved the land with a deeper emotion than could any proprietor. He felt himself as much a part of it as the rocks and trees, the animals and birds. His homeland was holy ground, sanctified for him as the resting place of the bones of his ancestors and the natural shrine of his religion. He conceived its waterfalls and ridges, its clouds and mists, its glens and meadows, to be inhabited by the myriad of spirits with whom he held daily communion." So here you have, in a sense, it reveals the full impact of what had happened in what is now the United States, that those with a sacred connection to nature and spirit were destroyed by those who claim to have a connection to spiritual values, but essentially were chained to private property, profit, and power. And in order to pursue those ends, had to destroy these other cultures. You can also look on page 137, in which a Moravian minister is quoted by Van Every about how Indian life was governed, and ask ourselves, when we think about that, in terms of the fairly egalitarian, and this is without romanticizing some of the serious violence that existed between various Indian nations, but I'm talking internally now. When we ask about how Indian life was governed, we perhaps should ask ourselves again, who have been the civilized ones, the ones truly connected to the great circle of life and land? These profound differences are also found in Zinn's discussion regarding the Indian Removal Bill, which actually had a real debate and a narrow passage in the United States. It's amazing to think that there at least was enough of a debate about what happened, and also in the debate and discussion about the laws passed by the state, what is now the state of Georgia, to take Cherokee land. And we need to reflect deeply as well, and here I'm quoting on page 140, about the Golden Rule by the Cherokee. We entreat those to whom the foregoing paragraphs are addressed. This was a plea to the United States that people did not want to be removed from their ancient lands as they were, and of course, forced on the Trail of Tears through bitter weather where thousands died. It says, we entreat those to whom the foregoing paragraphs are addressed to remember the great law of love. Do to others as ye would that others should do to you. We pray them to remember that, for the sake of principle, their forefathers were compelled to leave, therefore driven from the old world, and that the winds of persecution wafted them over the great waters and landed them on the shores of the new world, when the Indian was the sole lord and proprietor of these extensive domains. Let them remember in what way they were received by the savage of America when power was in his hand and his ferocity could not be restrained by any human arm. Ward Churchill, scholar, argues that in the initial contact in what is now the United States, he has been unable to find a single incident in which Native Americans or American Indians visited violence on Europeans. The Europeans always initiated that violence. And then, of course, you're on your own land, and people responded in kind. So when we think about the Golden Rule, when we think of the connection of people with the land and the incredible tragedy that unfolded, let's say if you begin in 1607, began before that, certainly in the Southwest, but here in the East, and you think about the nature of the Golden Rule that we learned in schools and from our parents, that is what I would call the human Golden Rule, as opposed to what I would argue the Golden Rule that runs this country, which is he who has the gold makes the rules. That's the real rule that dominates. We see what a tragedy unfolded and how this Golden Rule was savaged by Jackson and others in this period. So we have a history in which treaties were broken, in which there was relentless expansion and violence from what is now Cape Cod. You can walk around on Cape Cod and to some Indian burial grounds that still exist, or on Martha's Vineyard. So from almost the furthest eastern outpost of the United States, all the way, of course, as we discussed last time, all the way here into California, in one long, unbroken, relentless effort to break treaties and to engage in violence. Yet there seems to be, at this point in our history, little shame among the general population and virtually none among elected officials about what the historical record shows us clearly are crimes. They are documented. This is not Howard Zinn developing some interpretation. The debate is in the interpretation. We have the history just the way we have the history about Columbus. I'm going to finish up with just a couple of comments on the Trail of Tears and the loss of life for the Cherokee as they were marched across from what is now the Southeast to Indian territory, which was set aside for Native Americans or Indians, which then became Oklahoma, which then was overrun when they opened those lands up and whites came in and pushed Indians out. Regarding the Trail of Tears, I come back to an issue that I raised last time from the scholarship of historian David Stannard on the moral ranking of victims. We learn, as we should, of the untold thousands, hundreds of thousands, who knows how many, numbers of Jews who lost their lives in forced marches near the end of World War II. Many of us growing up learned about the infamous Bataan March in World War II of U.S. prisoners of war by the Japanese. We identify with them as any reasonable person on this earth would. But we have learned precious little about the Trail of Tears and those victims. Once again, I would argue, proving Stannard's thesis that it is the nature of the victim and the victimizer that shapes the educational and moral lessons that we learn, not the crime itself. It is highly selective. It depends on who you're bombing, who you're burning, who's got power, who doesn't. It's not that we have a principled objection to violence, all right? And as far as I know, in terms of certainly U.S. presidents and the Congresses, since we became a formal nation and Washington became president in 1789, I don't know of any American president who's been a pacifist. So it's not the crime itself. It's the victim and the victimizer. Even though, arguably, in this country, the crime against original Americans is our great Holocaust, our great sin. But it has been denied and ignored and distorted so much that history and memory are not allowed to shape the present. And that's one of the powerful aspects, I think, of his work, is that we're forced to deal with this in the present but have to have memory about the past in order to confront what is happening in this society today to the descendants of those who lost their land centuries ago, given the unemployment rates among American Indians and all sorts of other social aspects that are clearly the worst in the country. It's not as if these issues disappeared and now everything's fine.
That was John Marciano, Professor Emeritus of SUNY Cortland, speaking on Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Since 2004, he's been giving a public class on Zinn's work in Santa Monica, California. Thanks to the LA Sound Posse and Richard Ingram for that recording. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, WRFN Nashville, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren. The Onondaga Nation is a member of what is now commonly referred to as the Haudenosaunee, a name translated as People of the Longhouse, an alliance of Native nations united for the past several hundred years by complementary traditions, beliefs, and cultural values. Sometimes referred to as the Iroquois Confederacy or Six Nations, the Haudenosaunee originally consisted of the Mohawk, Oneida, Onondaga, Cayuga, and Seneca nations. The Tuscarora migrated from the south and peacefully joined the Confederacy in the early 1700s, bringing to six the number of nations united by Haudenosaunee traditional law. Established sometime between 900 and 1500 AD, the Haudenosaunee not only predates the founding of the United States, but also existed prior to contact with Europeans, making it one of the world's earliest and longest functioning democracies. Guided by the Great Law of Peace, complete with a sophisticated system of checks and balances, the Haudenosaunee system influenced early American governments far more than it was influenced by them. Prior to the American Revolution, the Haudenosaunee inhabited much of what is now New York State, along with parts of Pennsylvania, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Vermont. They occasionally entered into strategic alliances and negotiated treaties with other nations, both native and non-native, covering issues of trade and commerce and other matters. The first such treaties were with the Dutch, then with the French and British, and finally with the newly formed United States government. At the conclusion of the Revolutionary War, the United States decided to give 600 acres of land to each war veteran in lieu of monetary compensation, land which it did not own or possess. In New York State, much of the land earmarked for veterans was owned by the Haudenosaunee. A treaty in 1768 between the Haudenosaunee and the British Crown, and carried forward by the United States, prohibited any white settlement west of Rome, New York. Onondaga territory lies west of Rome and consists of a 40 to 50 mile wide swath of land stretching from Pennsylvania to Canada, bordered to the east by the lands of the Oneida Nation and to the west by the lands of the Cayuga Nation. Onondaga and Haudenosaunee ownership of this land was further confirmed when the newly formed United States entered into the Treaty of Fort Stanwix in 1784. The treaty reserved for the Haudenosaunee all the land they owned in New York State, with the exception of small parcels near Fort Oswego and Fort Niagara. Another important treaty was the Treaty of Canandaigua in 1794, which reaffirmed the principles of peace and friendship between the two nations while clarifying the international boundaries between them. In July of 1788, the state of New York ratified the United States Constitution, which explicitly reserves for the federal government the exclusive power to make treaties with other nations, including native nations. Just 2 months later, however, New York Governor George Clinton convinced an unauthorized group of Onondagas to, quote, sell nearly 2 million acres of land to New York. Despite the fact the governor had just signed the Constitution, which prohibited such action, and despite the fact that the signatories were not Onondaga or Haudenosaunee representatives. Backed by the force of New York State, this illegal agreement relegated the Onondagas to approximately 108 square miles of territory, including most of present-day Syracuse, and also reserved to the Onondagas a one-mile swath of land around Onondaga Lake for the purposes of making salt in common with others. Over the next 35 years, additional agreements, quote-unquote, with New York State included purported Onondaga cessions and took most of the remainder of the reserved lands. These illegal actions and fraudulent takings form the basis for the Onondaga Nation's current lawsuit. Like the United States federal government, the Haudenosaunee is in itself a constitutional government, holding the power to resolve differences between member nations and to guarantee that its members are of one mind on matters of international treaties, territorial disputes, international trade, or any other issue that affects the long-term welfare of the Confederacy. The chiefs of the Grand Council are designated advocates of peace and hold the future welfare of the people in their hands. They're empowered to deliberate, to consider all options, to arrive at consensus, and to legislate laws that are added to the collective set of laws called the Great Law. The Confederacy and the acceptance of the Great Law of Peace that governs it was concluded on the shores of Onondaga Lake, which is now surrounded by the city of Syracuse and has been the dumping ground of toxic detritus of various corporations. The entire Haudenosaunee has 50 chiefs. When in council, every chief has an equal responsibility and equal say in the matters of the Haudenosaunee. It is the responsibility of the chiefs to protect the people within the circle and to look forward 7 generations to the future in making decisions. The chiefs are chosen for a lifetime tenure by the clan mothers from among men who display the necessary qualities of a leader. Each chief works with his clan mother and their clan, who may remove him if he is not fulfilling the responsibilities to the nation and the clan. Onondaga is the site of the Central Council Fire, or one might say the capital, of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, and thus Onondaga has special spiritual responsibilities as the fire keepers. The first program in our series is titled The Nation in Our Midst, Onondaga History, Culture, and Spirituality, and was held in Syracuse on February 27th. Tadadaho Sid Hill is the spiritual leader of the Haudenosaunee, and the first voice you will hear will be his.
Anytime we meet in any kind of an assembly with our people, no matter how large or how small, we always start our meetings with thanking for everything that the Creator has given us. First of all, greeting the people that everybody's here and well and come here safely, and that everybody is in a peaceful mind. And we thank Mother Earth for all the things that she's doing and that she's still doing, her duties that's been given to her, and all the things that's on Mother Earth, all the plants, the animals, the birds, the waters, all the things that we have planted, the medicines. We give all thanks and acknowledge all those that's been just set down here for us to use and to use in a good way, and to respect those things and appreciate those things that has been given to us. Then we thank the things that have been, like in the sky world, thank the thunders which bring the rains and wash the earth. We thank the sun which brings the warmth and the light to the earth, the moon who has her duties of regulating the cycle for the women and bringing children, the stars which a long time ago our people knew could go by the stars, and we use them to travel and to set our ceremonies. We thank, we have these four, I guess you would call, we call them protectors that watch over us as we wander on the earth because of all the dangers that are there, and they help guide us and protect us as we roam about earth. We give thanks to one of the last messages that we received that has enabled us to continue with our ceremonies and still and live in these two worlds. And that's Handsome Lake, we call Svenja Dayo. So we give him a special honor for bringing us this message to help our people continue our ceremonies. And I end up with giving thanks to the Creator for all the things that he's given us, and that he still loves us and he still sends his love to us. It's and all those things that we talk about that sometimes we take for granted sometimes, and we forget to be thankful of all the things that we have, especially with the things that's been given to us to survive, but also we can't forget our families and the people and the friends that we have around us and the people we're involved with every day to help one another, get along with one another. And I think that's what's been told to us by our leaders. Our messages was all about getting along with one another and respecting one another. Thank you.
Welcome again. My name is Phil Arnold. I teach in the religion department at Syracuse University. This night has been a long time in planning, and it's great to see so many people here that have been really active in this series of events. I just want to do a short introduction to why why various groups at Syracuse, around Syracuse, wanted this series of events to happen. It's really to bring together the greater Syracuse community with the Onondaga Nation to foster some kind of intercultural learning and understanding in light of recent events. It's important also to mention that of the, 550-some Native nations throughout North America, only three are still governed by their ancient ceremonial processes, and one of those is the Onondaga Nation, and it's not often that people get to acknowledge that certainly in my classes it's not something that students readily know about. So we have here in Syracuse a real opportunity to connect with some ancient wisdom and to begin to appreciate what kind of possibilities that are maybe around the corner here in this area. Also, I'd like to mention that there's a lot of people all over the world that are interested in the Onondaga Nation and what's going to happen with this recent land rights action that was filed almost a year ago now. I was Me and my family we had the opportunity to accompany a delegation from the Onondaga Nation to Japan. And as many of you already know, they travel on their own passports, and that was a complicated process. But what was really remarkable was how much the Japanese already knew about the Haudenosaunee and about the Onondaga Nation, and how warmly the Japanese received the delegation, how they were really sort of up to speed on things like we'll be talking about, like the relationship between the Haudenosaunee and the women's rights movement, and the relationship between the Haudenosaunee and the development of democracy. So much so that this last August, a Japanese delegation came back here to Syracuse to meet with the Onondaga Nation, to acknowledge what they saw as the indigenous root of their own democratic system. So those kinds of things are not, you know, part of the workaday world, and I just wanted to mention them as a way of introducing the series. Something else, too, in general, this series, which will be occurring over the next year, is a recognition that the Onondagas have extended their hand in seeking a healing of relationships and the earth through their land rights action filed last March. Our belief as organizers of this series is that significant education is needed for us to truly understand the issues and respond thoughtfully to the Onondagas. I wanted to read to you just briefly the introduction of this land rights action, because it's quite unique in terms of a legal document. And sort of, it's beautifully written. I don't know who did it, but it's a wonderful example of what the possibilities of the land rights action might be. The Onondaga people wish to bring about a healing between themselves and all others who live in this region that has been the homeland of the Onondaga Nation since the dawn of time. The nation and its people have a unique spiritual, cultural, and historic relationship with the land, which is embodied in the Great Law of Peace. This relationship goes far beyond federal and state legal concepts of ownership, possession, or legal rights. The people are one with the land and consider themselves stewards of it. It is the duty of the nation's leaders to work for a healing of this land, to protect it, and to pass it on to future generations. The Onondaga Nation brings this action on behalf of its people in the hope that it may hasten the process of reconciliation and bring lasting justice, peace, and respect among all who inhabit the area. Audrey Shenandoah is a clan mother at the Onondaga Nation, and she's a world-renowned speaker. She's spoken at the UN. She's traveled with the Dalai Lama. She has a wonderful global perspective, as well as a local commitment to the area. The Taradao Sid Hill is also well known to many of you, and I'll just let them take it away.
Well, I'd just like to welcome everybody here tonight. We seem to have a good crowd here, and good to see everybody and get out of the cold here a little bit. Talking about the land rights action, ever since I was a child, I've always heard about our leaders and my family and everybody in the community about filing the land rights, and we've always heard about lease on Syracuse and all the history, and it was all kind of mixed up in there between family talks and doing ceremonies. And you know, my uncle was a previous Taradaho, so I knew, I always heard about all the discussion that was going on in council, and they would come into our homes and in our families and talking about one day going to court and seeing if we can seek justice in the system of that we don't have much. I guess I don't have much faith in myself, because we know we're not really part of that system. We've heard about this, and I'm sure Audrey, all her life, has heard about filing and going into court. So it was a big decision that I've heard all my life, and I guess it was time. I hope it was time to do this. I think some of the things that pushed us or kind of persuaded us to file this, and not so much for I guess not for damages, but just seeing what was going on in the world, more or less, and with all the problems with the environment, and here with the Onondaga Lake, and our struggles over there, and all their solutions to clean it up, and I guess not being part of that, and we're always, always say, well, it's Onondaga Lake, but we should be involved in it. We're Onondagas. It's water. It's important. There's medicines there. There's fish there. The animals use this. Our people used to use this. We should have some kind of input into our environment, as everybody should. And I guess that's what kind of pushed our leaders to say that maybe it would give us a voice in some of these kind of catastrophes that are going on in our environment, in our waters, in our lands, and in the air, the air that we breathe. We've always had these concerns. We look at the health of our people, the things that our elders had that they talked about that we don't have, that we don't do. We hear about all their spear and fish, and the things they used to do in the creeks and up along. And I have uncles who used to trap into the swamps. I hear them stories. And those things are no longer done, and that's change. That's change with our people, what we do, how we get into the workforce, and now we're all part of that workforce too. We're getting away from our planting and some of the farming. So we've changed a lot too, but we've always tried to maintain some of our ways, our beliefs, as much as we could. And tried to pass that on, trying to retain our language, Onondaga language. We have a few elders left that still speak fluently. And we have a series of language programs on the nation, as in all the nations across New York and Canada, as far as the Haudenosaunee are trying to save these languages. And I think we kind of did this for the just the way things are going in the world. So when we talk about when we give thanksgiving, and when we mention all the things that have given to us, and we ask for things at certain times, but that's for everybody. It's not just for us. Everybody has that right to drink clean water, breathe clean air, and to be able to have a good place and a good healthy place to live. That should be everybody's concern. And if it was a way of addressing some of these things, of where we can be heard, and where we can educate, and we can learn too. And we can learn how to. Can we fix these things? Can we do better things in the future? Do better ways? There's always room to learn and what we teach our younger people in the future. So I think a lot of that was all these years of hearing the leaders talk about when this time would come. And we use it as a healing. And that's it. We wanted to do something different than just looking for damages, money. It's more than that. And I think that's what pushed us to do it in this manner and try to do it in a good way, as good as possible, even though all those things in the past that our two peoples have gone through. We can't undo them things, but we can do things better.